Let's be pirates. As the Macintosh team grew, it moved from Texaco Towers to the main Apple buildings on Bandley Drive, finally settling in mid-1983 into Bandley 3. It had a modern atrium lobby with video games, which Burl Smith and Andy Hertzfeld chose, and a Toshiba compact disc stereo system with Martin Logan speakers and 100 CDs. The software team was visible from the lobby in a fishbowl-like glass enclosure, and the kitchen was stocked daily with Odwalla juices. Over time, the atrium attracted even more toys, most notably a Bösendorfer piano and a BMW motorcycle that Jobs felt would inspire an obsession with lapidary craftsmanship. Jobs kept a tight rein on the hiring process. The goal was to get people who were creative, wickedly smart, and slightly rebellious. The software team would make applicants play Defender, Smith's favorite video game. Jobs would ask his usual offbeat questions to see how well the applicant could think in unexpected situations. One day, he, Hertzfeld, and Smith interviewed a candidate for software manager who, it became clear as soon as he walked in the room, was too uptight and conventional to manage the wizards in the fishbowl. Jobs began to toy with him mercilessly. "How old were you when you lost your virginity?" he asked. The candidate looked baffled. "What did you say?" "Are you a virgin?" Jobs asked. The candidate sat there flustered, so Jobs changed the subject. "How many times have you taken LSD?" Hertzfeld recalled, "The poor guy was turning varying shades of red, so I tried to change the subject and asked a straightforward technical question." But when the candidate droned on in his response, Jobs broke in. "Gobble, gobble, gobble, gobble," he said, cracking up Smith and Hertzfeld. "I guess I'm not the right guy," the poor man said as he got up to leave. For all of his obnoxious behavior, Jobs also had the ability to instill in his team an esprit de corps. After tearing people down, he would find ways to lift them up and make them feel that being part of the Macintosh project was an amazing mission. Every 6 months, he would take most of his team on a 2-day retreat at a nearby resort. The retreat in September 1982 was at the Pajaro Dunes near Monterey. 50 or so members of the Mac division sat in the lodge facing a fireplace. Jobs sat on top of a table in front of them. He spoke quietly for a while, then walked to an easel and began posting his thoughts. The first was "Don't compromise." It was an injunction that would over time be both helpful and harmful. Most technology teams made trade-offs. The Mac, on the other hand, would end up being as insanely great as Jobs and his acolytes could possibly make it, but it would not ship for another 16 months, way behind schedule. After mentioning a scheduled completion date, he told them it would be better to miss than to turn out the wrong thing. A different type of project manager, willing to make some trade-offs, might try to lock in dates after which no changes could be made. Not Jobs. He displayed another maxim: it's not done until it ships. Another chart contained a Cohen-like phrase that he later told me was his favorite maxim: the journey is the reward. The Mac team, he liked to emphasize, was a special corps with an exalted mission. Someday they would all look back on their journey together and, forgetting or laughing off the painful moments, would regard it as a magical high point in their lives. At the end of the presentation, someone asked whether he thought they should do some market research to see what customers wanted. "No," he replied, "because customers don't know what they want until we've shown them." Then he pulled out a device that was about the size of a desk diary. "Do you want to see something neat?" When he flipped it open, it turned out to be a mock-up of a computer that could fit on your lap, with a keyboard and screen hinged together like a notebook. "This is my dream of what we will be making in the mid to late 80s, he said. They were building a company that would invent the future. For the next 2 days, there were presentations by various team leaders and the influential computer industry analyst Ben Rosen, with a lot of time in the evenings for pool parties and dancing. At the end, Jobs stood in front of the assemblage and gave a soliloquy. "As every day passes, the work 50 people are doing here is going to send a giant ripple through the universe," he said. "I know I might be a little hard to get along with, but this is the most fun thing I've done in my life." Years later, most of those in the audience would be able to laugh about the "little hard to get along with" episodes and agree with him that creating that giant ripple was the most fun they had in their lives. The next retreat was at the end of January 1983, the same month the Lisa launched, and there was a shift in tone. 4 months earlier, Jobs had written on his flip chart, "Don't compromise." This time, one of the maxims was, "Real artists ship." Nerves were frayed. Atkinson had been left out of the publicity interviews for the Lisa launch, and he marched into Jobs' hotel room and threatened to quit. Jobs tried to minimize the slight, but Atkinson refused to be mollified. Jobs got annoyed. "I don't have time to deal with this now," he said. "I have 60 other people out there who are pouring their hearts into the Macintosh, and they're waiting for me to start the meeting." With that, he brushed past Atkinson to go address the faithful. Jobs proceeded to give a rousing speech in which he claimed that he had resolved the dispute with Macintosh Audio Labs to use the Macintosh name. In fact, the issue was still being negotiated, but the moment called for a bit of the old reality distortion field. He pulled out a bottle of mineral water and symbolically christened the prototype on stage. Down the hall, Atkinson heard the loud cheer and with a sigh joined the group. The ensuing party featured skinny dipping in the pool, a bonfire on the beach, and loud music that lasted all night, which caused the hotel, La Playa in Carmel, to ask them never to come back. Another of Jobs's maxims at the retreat was, "It's better to be a pirate than to join the Navy." He wanted to instill a rebel spirit in his team, to have them behave like swashbucklers who were proud of their work but willing to commandeer from others. As Susan Kerr put it, he meant, "Let's have a renegade feeling to our group. We can move fast. We can get things done." To celebrate Jobs' birthday a few weeks later, the team paid for a billboard on the road to Apple headquarters. It read, "Happy 28th, Steve. The journey is the reward. The Pirates." One of the Mac team's programmers, Steve Capps, decided this new spirit warranted hoisting a Jolly Roger. He cut a patch of black cloth and had Care paint a skull and crossbones on it. The eye patch she put on the skull was an Apple logo. Late one Sunday night, Capps climbed to the roof of their newly built Bandley 3 building and hoisted the flag on a scaffolding pole that the construction workers had left behind. It waved proudly for a few weeks until members of the Lisa team in a late-night foray stole the flag and sent their Mac rivals a ransom note. Capps led a raid to recover it and was about to wrestle it from a secretary who was guarding it for the Lisa team. Some of the grown-ups overseeing Apple worried that Jobs' buccaneer spirit was getting out of hand. "Flying that flag was really stupid," said Arthur Rock. "It was telling the rest of the company they were no good." But Jobs loved it, and he made sure it waved proudly all the way through to the completion of the Mac project. "We were the renegades, and we wanted people to know it," he recalled. Veterans of the Mac team had learned that they could stand up to Jobs. If they knew what they were talking about, he would tolerate the pushback, even admire it. By 1983, those most familiar with his reality distortion field had discovered something further. They could, if necessary, just quietly disregard what he decreed. If they turned out to be right, he would appreciate their renegade attitude and willingness to ignore authority. After all, that's what he did. By far the most important example of this involved the choice of a disk drive for the Macintosh. Apple had a corporate division that built mass storage devices, and it had developed a disk drive system, codenamed Twiggy, that could read and write onto those thin, delicate 5 1/4-inch floppy disks that older readers, who also remember Twiggy the model, will recall. But by the time the Lisa was ready to ship in the spring of 1983, it was clear that the Twiggy was buggy. Because the Lisa also came with a hard disk drive, this was not a complete disaster, but the Mac had no hard disk, so it faced a crisis. "The Mac team was beginning to panic," said Hertzfeld. "We were using a single Twiggy drive, and we didn't have a hard disk to fall back on." The team discussed the problem at the January 1983 retreat, and Debbie Coleman gave Jobs data about the Twiggy failure rate. A few days later, he drove to Apple's factory in San Jose to see the Twiggy being made. More than half were rejected. Jobs erupted. With his face flushed, he began shouting and sputtering about firing everyone who worked there. Bob Belleville, the head of the Mac engineering team, gently guided him to the parking lot where they could take a walk and talk about alternatives. One possibility that Belleville had been exploring was to use a new 3 1/2-inch disk drive that Sony had developed. The disk was cased in sturdier plastic and could fit into a shirt pocket. Another option was to have a clone of Sony's 3 1/2-inch disk drive manufactured by a smaller Japanese supplier, the Alps Electronics Company, which had been supplying disk drives for the Apple II. Alps had already licensed the technology from Sony, and if they could build their own version in time, it would be much cheaper.